I'm Afshin Rathansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE, 121 years since the birth of the great Chilean diplomat and poet Pablo Neruda. They sell the soul of the people to the highest bidder and call it diplomacy, he said, before the CIA-backed coup that would kill Salvador Allende. Diplomacy is now key in this region, 19 years since the defeat of Israel by Lebanon. Today, amidst genocide in Gaza, a Trump military attack on Iran, an Iranian attack on U.S. interests in Qatar, there is also continued UK-US-EU armed war on Yemen, Lebanon, and Syria. World trade hinges on the Straits of Hormuz, 160 miles from this studio. And yet, Donald Trump has been busy this week thanking Netanyahu at the White House for Netanyahu's Nobel Peace Prize nomination, considering the establishment of a Rafah concentration camp and shaking hands on a Holocaust. This while most Americans do not favor Israel, and only 16%, according to YouGov, think Mossad agent Jeffrey Epstein killed himself. The Trump administration thinks differently. Then again, Elon Musk said Trump and MAGA philosopher Steve Bannon are in the so-called Epstein files that now no longer exist. Joining me again from Salt Lake City in Utah is former U.S. Missile Defense Agency consultant and current Deputy Director of National Operations for the U.S. Task Force on National and Homeland Security, David Pine. David, thank you so much for coming back on Going Underground. We don't know whether at the time of this being broadcast around the world, Trump will have entered again a war with Yemen and again a war on Iran. The New York Times, no one reads it, of course, but it says, U.S. needs to finish the job in Iran, at the top of their headline a few days ago, quoting Bolton. And when I'm speaking to you from this region, and people are going something different. BRICS nations condemn strikes on Iran, slam unilateral Trump tariffs. What do you make of how Trump is making his decisions? He seemed to be suggesting the attacks on Iran were great, not understanding the debate in Iran is now whether to get nuclear weapons against the fatwa of Ayatollah Khomeini, and that now is the time for Iran to abandon its civil nuclear program for nuclear weapons.
Hey, Afshin, thanks again for having me on your show. President Trump has pursued a policy that is a little bit a bipolar, I would say. Initially, he began with a great success negotiating a ceasefire agreement between Israel and Gaza at his behest, essentially, before he was even sworn into office. And since, beginning in March, he authorized Israel to violate that. He started a war with Yemen, and he's become increasingly, he's acted almost as the leader of a rogue state, unfortunately. Netanyahu, I think, is probably the greatest rogue state leader in the world today, bombing and invading countries with little or no justification. And unfortunately, I think that President Trump's decision to bomb Iran was done on false pretenses. We heard from U.S. intelligence agencies that that Iran supposedly does not have a nuclear program. I think that they do, but there's no immediate risk. There's no immediate risk of some kind of Iranian nuclear strike against the U.S. or Israel, because they're credibly deterred by Iran's and America's superior nuclear arsenals. But it is troubling. As you mentioned, there have been rumors that Trump is considering bombing Iran again. I myself would be quite surprised about that. The ceasefire.
Presumably, David, you were surprised the first time, though. You were presumably surprised earlier in the month.
Well, I was surprised that Israel attacked Iran. I was not surprised that the U.S. attacked Iran after that, because there was so many reports that it was imminent. But I think it was a huge mistake. I think it did nothing for U.S. national security. In fact, I think it potentially made U.S. national security more at risk in terms of incentivizing Iran to pursue nuclear weapons at a much faster rate, knowing that nuclear weapons are the only credible deterrent against a potential renewed U.S. and Israeli aggression. I think it was a huge mistake, and I think Trump needs to Stop putting Israel first, stop putting Ukraine first, and start putting America first.
I do want to go into some of those geopolitical matters later, but you are an expert specifically in the security of the homeland. So what you said just there, how, if let alone the wrong intel Trump is receiving about how to make decisions in this wider geopolitical space, do you think he's getting intelligence about the dangers to the homeland because of the decisions he is making? What are the dangers now to the United States because of these policies Trump has been pursuing these past 6 months, from the bombing in Yemen right through to the bombing of Iran and now cozying up to Netanyahu yet again in the White House? What can Iran do to the United States, and what can others expressing solidarity unilaterally against the United States do to the U.S.?
Well, Iran has a number of options to attack the U.S., both in terms of attacking U.S. forces and the 50 military bases we have in the region, U.S. carrier strike groups. They have hypersonic missiles, which we cannot intercept. If they were proven accurate enough, it's very likely that they could strike a U.S. carrier. Probably they couldn't sink it, but they could cause it to catch fire and live away. That would be a tremendous blow to U.S. prestige. Other things that they can do is they have tremendous offensive cyber capabilities. They've demonstrated a capability to take down our water purification distribution system, at least on a regional basis. I would assess that they have the capability to shut down America's entire critical infrastructure for a period of weeks, perhaps months. And that would be devastating to the U.S. I don't think there's anyone that doubts that they have that capability. In terms of nuclear capabilities, I assess that they likely already have nuclear weapons. Whether they have the miniaturization technology necessary to put them atop missiles is unclear. But I think it's likely that they had a nuclear test in North Korea as recently as 2017. They also may have likely have super EMP satellites. Super EMP is a way that Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran could potentially take out all U.S. critical infrastructure at the beginning of a conflict, or even in the case of Russia or China, before a nuclear first strike against the United States. So those are all devastating capabilities that could potentially kill tens of millions of Americans, and there's not a lot the U.S. can do about it because U.S. leaders have spent so much time with offensive power projection with conventional forces around the world and neglected our homeland and strategic defenses here at home.
Iran, of course, clearly denies any possession of nuclear weapons on the theological basis. And, well, to put my Netanyahu hat on, I would say, yes, those threats have been discussed, perhaps assessed. But the fact is, Iran keeps threatening, has lost to a great deal Hezbollah in Lebanon, and has lost lots of its support and allies in terms of power there. And, I mean, it was curious, the attack on the U.S. base in Qatar. Trump proudly talking about the warnings given by Iran. We saw Pezeshkian giving a very, some would say, over-conciliatory interview to Tucker Carlson, where he seemed to not be acting as a leader, arguably, of a country that had just been bombed. And so all the threats you just outlined there are just hyperbole. Actually, Iran is, I mean, inside there is debate about going stronger, the line that you're taking. But actually, the leadership doesn't seem to be pursuing the kinds of aims you outlined.
Well, I think the leadership, obviously they have discontinued IAEA inspectors, the inspection regime. So that, to me, clearly indicates, malevolent intent. I think Iran has the right to nuclear weapons. They've had, nuclear weapons program really dating probably since the 90s. We know that they purchased four nuclear weapons from Kazakhstan. Those were not operational. They didn't have the launch codes, but they were able to reverse engineer those. Again, it's a matter of open debate whether they actually have nuclear weapons at this point, or whether they're in fact.
I have to say, I lived there for a while, and I was pretty convinced there was this religious fatwa in operation, and there was a lot of opposition to Khomeini and Khamenei. They're not really called the supreme leader when you're in Iran because they're responsible to the Assembly of Experts. And but anyway, now it definitely is after Trump, clearly. I did see you saying something about, of course, policy could have changed if Khamenei had been assassinated in these latest round of strikes, or perhaps strikes coming up. You talked about it on our program when you came on last time, but what's your understanding of what the immediate trigger would be if the leader of Iran was, if Khamenei was assassinated, what that would trigger in terms of the effect on NATO countries in this cyber age?
Yeah, that's really the threat that everyone agrees on, is that Iran is likely the fifth-ranked cyber offensive power in the world. Russia, I think, is the first. The U.S. is probably the third, China the second. North Korea is the fourth. So they do have that capability that they could use not only against the U.S. homeland, but against NATO countries as well.
And what is it exactly, EMP?
Well, I'm talking about cyber capabilities, of course. With super EMP satellites, that would be a nuclear device that would be that's specially designed to maximize EMP effects. They currently have two satellites, the NOR-2 and NOR-3 satellites, orbiting at an altitude of 285 miles over the U.S. That is really an optimal altitude for a super EMP attack against the United States, because the EMP radius, effects radius, if it was exploded in the center of the United States around Missouri, could affect the entire continental United States. So that's to me is
and what does it do? What does it do? What is the effect?
Yeah, so it shuts off all electronics, internet, the ground transportation system. It would take out all the power. It would shut down, again, water distribution, purification systems. It would take down all airlines in flight. So we probably lose around 1 million people just from transportation related accidents within minutes. It would be extremely devastating. It would essentially destroy the United States as a functioning country, because the U.S. government would not be able to perform its functions or even to communicate, and would also seriously damage our nuclear command and control system, which is why Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran have EMP attack as kind of the war winning element of any war plan with the United States.
David Pyne, I'll stop you there. More from the Deputy Director of National Operations for the U.S. Task Force on National and Homeland Security after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with former U.S. Missile Defense Agency consultant and former international analyst for the U.S. Office of the Secretary of Defense, David Pyne. David, we were talking about the threats that Iran could impose on NATO countries should there be another attack on Iran. But I know you've been talking about how performative, I mean, obviously in Gaza, the genocide is not performative, but the strikes on Qatar, the strikes on Iran did seem to be, the IAEA saying no particulates from radioactive elements discovered, the USB-2 attack on Fordow, Natanz, and Isfahan, perhaps from Israel, meant to provoke a major response. But you believe that Trump and the Iranian government worked hand in hand?
Well, to some extent. I think the attacks themselves were real, but it's we've had multiple reports, including from an Iranian emigre associate of mine, that there was advance warning 24 to 48 hours that the Trump administration warned Iran of the specific targets that they would be bombing. We would be bombing, not necessarily the time that we would bomb them, but sufficient time for them to take to use 16 trucks to withdraw nearly half of their highly enriched uranium stockpile from the their main facility at Fordow. And then, of course, Iran returned the favor by giving us advance notice, perhaps an hour or more, that they would be attacking our abandoned main military base in Qatar. So it does definitely seem to be more carefully choreographed, show attacks, essentially. Each side is trying, the U.S. Tried to appease the neocons, showing that he was standing in solidarity with Israel, that he was very hardline against Iran, to much more than any former U.S. president in actually striking Iranian nuclear facilities. And then, of course, Iran doing the same thing to the U.S., just launching 14 missiles that were, kind of older ballistic missiles, cruise missiles that they had every reason to believe we would mostly shoot down. So in terms of the U.S.-Iran war, it almost wasn't even a real war, I think. And certainly Trump wanted to obliterate those nuclear facilities, but the initial DIA battle damage assessment assessed that not a single one of those facilities, the core facilities underground, were destroyed or collapsed.
How Trump doesn't want to talk about that, nor does the Iranian government. It suits both of them. I should say more than 1,000, many civilians were killed in the attacks on Iran, the United States and Israel. But I suppose one, if we can now establish that there are now threats to the homeland, to the United States because of this, we can definitely establish that the era of deterrence in West Asia is over. Iran can get through the so-called Iron Dome, beloved of Raytheon RTX shareholders. It's finished. Iran can destroy Tel Aviv in, 600 seconds with these missiles, with a constant barrage? And simultaneously, Iran can attack Dimona's nuclear weapons, Israel's nuclear weapons facilities. There's no protection over it. There's no deterrence at all now.
Well, I think that was the key reason that Netanyahu decided to accept Trump's ceasefire demand. He, previously wanted a regime change. It was really a regime change war. It wasn't the nuclear weapons was just a pretext. But the fact was that Iran was increasingly successful in causing major damage to Israeli cities and the port of Haifa, Tel Aviv, government and military facilities. And that Israel was reportedly about 7 days away from running out of missiles. I mean, they would have had some kind of residual capabilities, but running out of missile defense interceptors to defend Israel against Iranian ballistic missile attacks. Iran credibly, the Ayatollah has stated that he believes that Iran won the war with the U.S. and Israel. And I think that's largely an accurate assessment because, Israel, or rather Iran, stood up to the combined forces of the U.S. and Israel and caused them to essentially agree to Iran's terms for a ceasefire, which was that they would have to drop any demands for regime change. And commit to not attacking Iran again and with ballistic missile strikes on their nuclear facilities.
Like he agreed to the Ansar al-Assad Houthi terms earlier in the year, which of course brings me to the point is why is Trump doing this? Why is he doing Joe Biden two anyway? He's alienating his MAGA base. He's finished in terms of the midterms, as far as we can see. The amount of public money he's given to Israel, he's only been in 6 months, $45 billion, if you take the maximum estimates for military sales, economic aid. Obama was $35 billion, Biden $23 billion. Trump in 6 months, $45 billion. Why is he doing this? Is it really Jeffrey Epstein had this whole affair is something on him? One doesn't like to understand history in these sort of individual conspiracy Mossad agent systems. Why do you followed Trump closely? Why on earth is he doing this?
Well, I think President Trump made the mistake of appointing a lot of really bad people, neoconservatives, Israel first, America last individuals to serve in his cabinet. Marco Rubio, of course, is Secretary of State, now interim National Security Advisor as well. Former National Security Advisor Mike Waltz, who reportedly is still being paid to work at the National Security Agency as the National Security Advisor. And then John Ratcliffe at CIA as CIA director, and then is chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, is also very much pro-Israel. And then, of course, the CENTCOM commander, General Kirilla, is really, I guess, the worst. In fact, reportedly, Israel decided to attack Iran because they knew that our CENTCOM commander was so pro-Israel that they couldn't. They couldn't risk the next one being, more cautious and kind of, oppositional to Israel's plans to attack Iran. So I think he's just getting a lot of bad advice, and he's marginalized all the good people. You know, Tulsi Gabbard is director of national intelligence, Vice President J.D. Vance, even Pete Hegseth, you know, who, you know, when you listen to him, he sounds pretty anti-Iran, but behind the scenes, he's reportedly been arguing against the strikes. You know, the key for Trump to have a reset is to fire all the Israel first, essentially Mossad agents and all but name from his cabinet, and then hire, you know, folks like Tulsi Gabbard and J.D. Vance to replace them. And then we can, you know, we can put America first again and work collaboratively with all of the countries that are supporting peace, Russia and even Iran, to restore peace and stability in Europe and the Middle East.
Well, that's what we thought was happening when he fired the national security advisor. And it was well predicted, all of this. We did it on Going Underground. And he apparently is on the phone with Tucker Carlson occasionally. Steve Bannon, for all this Elon Musk business about him being in the Epstein files, clearly didn't think part of the MAGA philosophy is starting one war after another in West Asia. And now we have Trump threatening Putin and Xi Jinping on these deliberately leaked calls to look tough, and him wanting to send more U.S. public money to dictator Zelensky of Ukraine. Do you think it'll be up to Vladimir Putin to decide whether Trump has to comprehend his own base again and why he was elected to the White House in the first place? Because presumably you think Putin will not react happily to the latest remarks coming out of the White House?
Well, I think Putin has been an enormously rational and restrained leader of Russia. I think he's, you know, he's portrayed as some kind of war criminal, as you know, this huge aggressor, that he's has desires to reconquer the former Soviet Union, Eastern Europe. Nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, you know, every provocation that we've had where we've crossed Russian red lines, he's reacted very, very cautiously, very rationally, and with enormous strategic restraint. But there is a Russian red line. There's a nuclear red line. We don't know what it is. But if he were to continue escalating the war as Biden did, with attacks on, with Ukrainian strikes deep into Russia, perhaps more on their nuclear triad, we could trip that wire. And the only warning we'd have could be a mushroom cloud over a U.S. or NATO city. So it's critical that Trump pursue the grand strategic vision, which he articulated on the as a presidential candidate, which is peace with Russia, a geostrategic partnership with Moscow that is more economic than security based, but that would be designed to essentially not split Russia from China, but neutralize its military alliance with the People's Republic of China, to potentially deter Chinese aggression against Taiwan, but more importantly, to entirely remove the Russian nuclear threat to the United States. That, what so many of my compatriots here in the United States don't realize is that diplomacy is really the key to security. As long as you have some military strength, restraint and diplomacy, is the key to reestablishing U.S. national security and reducing the threat against everyday Americans here in the United States.
But we know that Trump was talking like that in his election campaigns. But as you just gave us a roll call of personnel, that clearly, we were talking about the end of deterrence in West Asia, there are clearly people like Rubio and the rest of them who don't believe that Russia is really deterrent worthy, that they talk. And these are the talking points all through the genocide Joe Biden years, of course. We don't care. Russia's never going to use tactical nuclear weapons, so we don't care. Those are again in power around the White House in this term, it seems.
Well, I think, to be fair, while Trump has reneged on his promises for peace with Russia in rejecting direct negotiations with the Russian Federation over his 22-point peace plan that was essentially an ultimatum, was like a take-it-or-leave-it plan, I do think that the U.S. has drastically reduced the level of military support for Ukraine. We aren't to my knowledge, we aren't shipping them weapons without having them pay for them. We're selling them arms. We do have that 10-year security agreement that Trump signed as under the auspices of a mineral deal that we would continue selling them arms, but at a much lower rate. The U.S. simply doesn't have the weapons to send to Ukraine. There's no amount of weapons, even if we had them, that could enable Ukraine to win its war with Russia. Russia's 35 times larger. It's got five times more people. Its military forces are roughly 2-1 in terms of the numbers of troops facing Ukraine and inside of Ukraine. And they also have troops available for a renewed northern offensive that could retake or surround the capital city of Kyiv at any time. Putin has the ability to give the green light and authorize that offensive, and he could defeat Ukraine within weeks by surrounding or partially surrounding Kyiv, forcing Zelensky back to the bargain table and to sign a modified Istanbul Agreement, as was almost accomplished in April of 2022.
So finally then, I know you've been reasonably partial towards Trump. At least you thought he was going to somehow be better with some of those good people. Unfortunately, do you think already we can write his legacy as the end of the non-proliferation treaty, the beginning of a nuclear arms race of the like the world has never seen in its history?
Well, I do think Russia and China have made tremendous strides in building up the size of their nuclear arsenal. I think the U.S. has been far more restrained. We simply don't have the capabilities. We haven't successfully produced a nuclear warhead from scratch in the last 33 years. As far as the nuclear arms race, it's only a race that both sides are racing, and the U.S. simply doesn't have the capability to race right now. We're trying to rebuild those nuclear production capabilities, but I think the bigger picture is you know, we have to have good relations with Russia, with China, with Iran and North Korea, because those are the countries that have the potential to destroy the United States. And, Putin understands that. He's been trying to have good relations with the U.S. and the West ever since he came to power at the end of 1999. And Trump seemed to understand that when he came to office. And I'm hopeful that he could, it's not too late for him to pivot. But you're right. If his presidential legacy ends up what it's looking like right now, he runs the risk of being considered a failed president.
David Pyne, thank you.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure.
And that's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those suffering the impact of the US-UK EU armed bombing of Gaza, Yemen, Syria, Lebanon, and Iran. We'll be back on Monday to speak with a former political officer at the Israeli Embassy in Washington, D.C. Until then, you can keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV, on rumble.com to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.